Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. Welcome to tonight's event with Paul Harding. Thanks for coming out on this lovely evening. Also, thank you, Elliott Bay Book Company, for inviting us to co-present this evening. We thank the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and finally, this event is supported by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. So to the Foundation's thousands of donors, including you here tonight, we say thanks very much for your support. I think that's it. Okay, here's Rick Simonson, Elliott Bay Book Company, to introduce the rest of the program. Thanks.
Thank you, Chris, and welcome also, and thank you very much for being here tonight. And we're delighted that Paul Harding is here, who was last here in the library 3 years ago, I think it was, sort of well along the life, the extraordinary life of his first book, Tinkers, a book that I suspect most of you know that it came from this very small publisher and became this incredible, it became a story of its own in terms of how what the life of that book, which resulted, among other things, in its receiving the 2010 Pulitzer Prize. So one of the books everyone's been looking forward to would be the next book, which he's here with tonight, a book called Enon, which I still haven't heard the word pronounced yet. I don't know if I'm doing it the right way or not. It's a striking and remarkable book. For those who read Tinkers, there's familiar terrain geographically, culturally, kind of in terms of some of the lineage of the characters, but because there are some related characters. But there's also further evidence of Paul Harding's growth as a writer. I mean, there's a certain kind of timeless quality to his writing that makes you feel like he's one of these writers that's been doing this for a long time in the work. And there's a grace and kind of understated quality there that actually almost belies that he's not been doing this that long. So this book is even more evidence of his growth and development as a writer. Paul Harding is a writer that has been doing, received various, besides the Pulitzer, has also received a Guggenheim Prize. He's taught, he's a very highly regarded teacher, among other places, University of Iowa Writers Workshop, Harvard, and Grinnell College. And he comes here from the country, more or less, that he writes of in the New England landscape. It's a palpably, beautifully written of setting, and I think it'll be fun to get to hear it read from and about tonight. So again, we thank you for both Elliott Bay and the Seattle Public Library, and now ask you to please join in giving a warm welcome back to the wonderful writer, Paul Harding.
Thank you kindly. If this wasn't a podcast, I'd just come and sit with you and read to you like we were in a bedtime reading. So the basic premise of the book Enon is a tragic one. There's no getting around it. It's the protagonist is a guy named Charlie Crosby, and he is one of the grandsons of George Crosby, who's the protagonist of Tinkers. And the basic premise of Enon is that he has lost his only child, his daughter Kate. And the time frame of the novel is from roughly the time of Kate's death to the first anniversary of her death. And the book is written in the first person, and it basically sort of takes the form of a monologue, almost like a confession. It's almost like St. Augustine, and it's him, Charlie, talking to the reader about how he tried to be, how he tried to survive the grief of the tragedy that has befallen him, and the different ways that he tried to be, not only survive, but try to be equal to the memory of his daughter. So I'm just going to plunge right in. I think the only thing you need to know maybe for the first part of the reading is that Charlie, in a moment of anger and frustration, punches a wall and he breaks his hand, for which he is given a bottle of painkillers, which he takes to eating like candy, which is one of his, you know, a problem that gets worse as the book goes along. So. One of the things also that happens is that after Kate's death and after he finds himself alone in his house, he finds it unbearable to stay at home. It's too difficult to be in the house and see her room and all of her stuff. So he takes to wandering the town day and night, all day, all night, the old paths, the forests around the lakes and the streams and all that sort of stuff. And then most nights, he just before dawn, he finds himself in the cemetery where Kate is buried, above her grave, behind her grave, up a hill, because he has this idea that he doesn't want her to see him, because he's ashamed of what has happened to him since her death. So he often ends up there. So I walked all afternoon through the woods and hidden meadows of Enon. The sun went down and dusk spread and darkness began to fall. At one point, it occurred to me that I had not eaten anything, but I felt neither hungry nor very thirsty. I reached the western shore of Enon Lake as the last light left the sky. I knelt down by the water and raised my broken hand above my head so it wouldn't get wet, and cupped some in my good hand and took a couple sips. The water was cold and clean-tasting, fine, mineral. I swallowed two pills with another mouthful, then jogged across the street and into the trees on the other side of the road, at the edge of one of Enon's 2 9-hole golf courses. The cemetery was a quarter mile away, back toward the village. It lay between the two golf courses, along the flank of a large hill. The golf courses and cemetery begin on flat tracts directly off the old post road to Boston, which then steeply elevate in a succession of rises. I crossed the near golf course and stepped over the stone wall into the upper part of the cemetery. Kate was buried below, toward the front, in the family plot, next to my grandfather, George Washington Crosby, and my grandmother, Norma Crosby, and my mother, Betsy Crosby, and where I will be buried when I die. My great-grandmother, Kathleen Crosby, is also buried in the cemetery in another section. It was just superstition, but I did not want to pass in front of Kate's grave. Without having paid attention, I realized I had taken at least twice as many pills as I ought to have, and maybe more. It almost felt as if I were levitating when I stopped walking and stood still and looked down through the shadows to where Kate's stone was. The moon was out, and there was a beautiful view from the top of the cemetery. Deer browsed on the golf greens below to my right, and the tombstones made of white marble glowed. A corner of the lake was visible below, past the road beyond the trees, sparkling. I sat and surveyed the land and looked down the hill toward the Norway maple under which my grandparents and my mother and my daughter lay. A stupor fell over me, and I floated without direction for some time, possibly hours, until I was roused by the voices of 2 young girls. They were sitting 15 yards away from me, to my left, cross-legged, face to face, hidden from the road behind an enormous rectangular white headstone, on the other side of which, as I knew from my many trips to read the inscriptions on both the cemetery's prominent memorials and its modest ones, lay a family of 6 named Smith, all of whom had died during an epidemic in 1839. The girls shared a cigarette and swapped a bottle of wine. They both bent forward to examine something on the ground between them. One took a drag from the cigarette and passed it back to the other and opened a small book she had in her lap. The girl with the book held it close to her face and fingered through the pages until she said, "Here it is." "What? What is it?" the other girl said. "Give me a second, will you?" The girl examined the book, then dropped it into her lap and stared at her friend. She said, "Dude, this deck is whacked. It's always so right. This card is that you lust for someone you know is evil." The other girl blew smoke out of her nose and clapped herself on the head, her forearm full of bracelets and trinkets clinking and twinkling in the moonlight, and groaned, "Oh man, that's Carl." Both girls had long, very dark, unkempt hair, which I assumed was dyed black, but could not tell for sure. They both had pale skin and heavy black eyeliner on, and very dark lipstick, which might have been black or a very dark shade of purple or red, and they both wore all black clothes. I guessed they were a couple years older than Kate. I liked them immediately and imagined Kate being their friend and going through a safe and uproarious adolescence with them. I even found myself wishing that they might do what they did in front of Kate's stone so that Kate could hear them and have the company, although she was too close to the road and the girls would have been overheard by someone walking his dog who would have probably called the police on his cell phone. I lay still where I was for half an hour while the girls sipped wine and smoked and used their tarot cards as prompts to talk about what was important to them. Their conversation was endearing, although I was embarrassed by a good deal of it, and embarrassed that I was eavesdropping on them. I did not want to try to sneak away or attempt to rise and act as if I'd stumbled on them by accident. I did not want to frighten or upset them. So I let them chatter and laugh and enjoyed the smell of the smoke from their cigarettes and looked up at the stars and tried to see if I could detect their movement through the sky and thought about Kate watching the whole scene and being amused by it and teasing me about it when we both returned home. Toward midnight, one of the girls said, "Man, it's almost 12. I gotta go. My parents will be home soon. They'll get all over me if I come in later than they do." The other girl said, "Yeah, me too." Both girls stood up and stretched and brushed off the backs of their skirts, their bracelets jingling. I heard the cork squeaking back into the mouth of the wine bottle. The girls walked back down the hill past my family, still talking but more quietly. They passed under the light of a street lamp and into shadow and were gone. If you look at the side of the hill between the 6th and 7th holes of the Enon Golf Club, west of the cemetery, you can still see traces of the foundation of the town's only windmill. The windmill burned down in 1661. Farther down the hill, by the road, near the putting green for the 10th hole, stood the house of the father of Sarah Good, who was condemned as a witch and hanged down the road in Salem in 1692, and who famously told her accuser that God would give him blood to drink. I wondered if the girls I had seen in the cemetery knew this. I imagined it would please them, that they'd feel an immediate kinship with her, like Kate always had from the time I first told her about the witch trials, perhaps one that ran deeper than their usual teenage sense of persecution. I read about Sarah Good in an old history of the town, published in 1823 for the town's bicentennial. It was striking that at the time, the author of the book, a man named Barnett Wood, already considered Sarah Good a part of the town's remote history. I like to think about the fact that he wrote his book 175 years before I read it, and that Sarah Good met her fate 131 years before he wrote it. Sarah was hanged in Salem, but there were nights when I passed through the center of the village and imagined her swinging in the winds from a gallows where the Civil War memorial is, which was originally a green used for common pasturage. The statue standing atop the pediment of the memorial is modeled after a man named Benjamin Conant, who fought in the Union Army and was famous for the grapevines he kept, and who repaired shoes before and after the war out of a small shack behind one of the larger houses along Main Street. The shack is still there and is now used as a tool shed by a dentist. Benjamin Conant's statue was erected in 1870 while he was still alive, 47 years after Barnett Wood published his book, A History of Enon, on the occasion of its bicentennial, 178 years after Sarah Good was hanged in Salem, 30 years after the first Crosby settled in Enon, and 135 years before my daughter was buried half a mile up the street. In fact, Barnett Wood and Benjamin Conant are both buried in the cemetery as well. I don't know where Sarah Good was buried, maybe in Salem. I never looked it up. But the woods of Enon are full of very old, unmarked graves, and hers may well be among them, along with the bones of animals and citizens, fathers and brothers, oxen and horses, mothers and aunts, sons and daughters, anonymous cats and owls, Puritans and Indians, and unnamed infants, getting their bones mixed in the currents of soil and groundwater, migrating beneath the foundations of our houses and the fairways of the golf courses, trading ribs and teeth and shins and knuckles, commuting under baseball diamonds in the beds of streams, snagging up on roots and rocks, shelves of granite and seams of clay. There are certainly more citizens of Enon beneath its 5,400 acres than there are above it. Just beneath our feet, on the other side of the surface of the earth, there is another subterranean Enon, which conceals its secret business by conducting it too slowly for its purposes to be observed by the living. So things only get worse from there, I'm afraid. But So one of the things that Charlie does is he takes all of those layers of town history and his imagination and what he's, you know, myth and legend and everything, and one of the things that he does to try to negotiate the memory of his daughter is he makes up different versions of her. He imagines different versions of her. So this is just one of those versions of her that he imagines. The obsidian girl moves through the trees at night. She moves across the fairway of the golf course near the road by the stone wall that acts as the hood for the footlights to a kind of stage. She is all but invisible, the girl of black glass, appearing only as a wobbly blur. She is a dark lens. Through her, the dark underpinnings of the world are visible, but they turn whoever might see them to stone, or to ice, or to salt, or to marsh grass. Every night, just before dawn, she climbs down into the hill through a hidden trap door. She sounds like a crystal decanter rolling along the granite seams that lead down to the heart of the hill, where a furnace burns all day and all night, and dark, vague men shovel coal into its white-hot mouth. When the girl made of black glass appears, the men lean their shovels against the walls of the chamber and retreat into the shadows. The girl steps in front of the furnace, and the heat roars out and over her like a shimmering hurricane. She tilts her head back and holds her hands out at her sides. The heat blasts at her, and the tips of her fingers begin to glow. The outlines of her face and arms and legs begin to buckle and kink. Her legs give at the knees, and the rest of her slides off them and drops in front of them. She remains upright for a moment, but then she topples face first onto the dirt floor in front of the open furnace. It appears as if she is sinking into the dirt at first, but she's actually melting. The glass girl is melting. The glass held the shape of a girl only while it was cool, but now it is molten and pools over the floor. There is no way to tell if the glass leaks out of the girl or if the girl leaks out of the glass. There is a sound that no human ear can hear, coming from a place no human eye can see, from deeper within the earth, but also from deep in the sky and the water and inside the trees and inside the rocks. The sound is a voice coming from deep inside the throat of the world. The sound is a note from a register so low no human ear can hear it, but many people throughout the town are disturbed from their sleep by it. It is a note from a song, the shape of which is too vast ever to know. It encompasses and sustains all that is human but is not loyal to the human, and it terrifies. The note is a part of great vaulted cathedrals of chords that keep the universe speeding out from its own genesis. It is sensate. And down in the chamber of the hill, it sounds both like weeping and like laughter, and both are at the grief of the glass girl, who throws herself in front of the fires every morning just before dawn, and who, to her unending despair, is remade every evening in a deeper foundry, and evicted from the depths of the hill, back to the surface, where the cool air flowing through the grass cools and sets her glass eyes and her glass brow, her glass brains and her glass heart, and she begins another night as the brittle memories of a man who is the father of a girl she never was. And so this is just, I'll read one last page. It's a whole chapter, but it's just a little over a page. And this is sort of dead in the center of the book, and sort of it's kind of a portrait of Charlie and his predicament kind of in a encapsulated. Late one winter night after the new year, which came and went without my being aware of it for 2 weeks, after I had lost track of how much whiskey I had drunk and how many pills I had crushed and snorted, I lapsed into a blackout and awoke nearly frozen in the cemetery 6 hours later. I was laid out on my side, stopped up against the backs of three closely laid headstones for three sisters who had all died on December 12, 1839 at 8, 7, and 5 years old. I was sure that my toes and fingers had frostbite. By the wind and the barest light in the east, I could tell that it must be after 5 in the morning. The sky was still full of stars, but they were not the limpid, tame stars of an early summer evening. They were cold, wild, staring, and ferocious. They were stars that had arrived in Enon's sky from the deepest trenches of space, from terrible, unimaginable beginnings. Their light democratized by the present moment, but in fact a vast, tangled thicket of times, of ghosted universes haunting the hillside with their artifacted light. Their light unsettled me the way the open eyes of a dead person would, because it is impossible to believe that open eyes do not see. Their light blazed in the eyes of Enon's dead for a moment in false resurrection. I rose and convulsed from the cold and retched from the poison. I looked over at the snow-covered golf course where kids sledded every winter and imagined the dead having sledding parties at midnight on the back slope of the hill, warming their finger bones in blue fires that they kindled in granite urns, laughing when they held their hands inside the flames. I imagined them melting clumps of dirty ice in a tin bucket over the fire and drinking the hot, muddy brew and cackling with glee as it ran off the backs of their jawbones and spattered down their ribs. I imagined them using headstones for sleds. The idea made me sick and I repented of it. I had the urge to go to Kate Stone and kneel in front of it and say, "I'm sorry," over and over again, because no matter how much I knew better, I could not stop myself from stepping over the same dark threshold night after night, trying to follow her into the country of the dead in order to fetch her back, even though she visited me in dreams and never left my waking thoughts. Memories of her feeding the birds and practicing running and playing cribbage were not enough. I was ravenous for my child and took to gorging myself in the boneyard, hoping that she might possibly meet me halfway or just beyond, one night, if only for an instant, step back into her own bare feet, onto the wet grass or fallen leaves or snowy ground of the living Enon, so that we could share just one last human word. It would be the... Thank you. Thank you kindly. So I'll be happy to take questions if anybody has.
Okay, I'm going to ask you one.
Yeah, okay.
How did you learn how to read so beautifully?
How did I learn how to read so beautifully? Well, you know, it just came naturally. No, I don't know. You know, I think of the prose in Enon, and even maybe even more so in Tinker's too, is sort of unlineated lyric poetry, a lot of it is. And so I revise it and I vet it by reading it out loud to myself to make sure that it sort of, it's the way that it sounds when it's spoken is sort of the way that I want it to sound when you read it to yourself, you know, in silence. But it's funny though, because I didn't love the audio version of Tinkers or what I had heard of it. So I volunteered, or I asked Random House if I could do the audio book for Enon, because I said, you know, I'm quite a mellifluous reader and I'm very, you know. And they said, okay, you can do it, you know. And it turns out, of course, in my naivete that, you know, it's not like reading 20 minutes of out of the book. It's actually voice acting. Which, you know, so that I could, you know, there's some very, very funny sort of situations where I was in the recording booth and the producer was on the other side of the glass and her sort of saying, "Can you make that sound a little bit more like a 13-year-old girl?" And me saying, "No, I can't. I don't know how to do that," you know. So it was interesting. It was an interesting experience, because it's just doing readings from it is very different than actually, you know, sort of acting the book out.
That was going to be my next question. So are you going to read the audio book for this?
Oh, yeah, that's
amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And would you do it again?
I don't know. I'd have to see. Maybe leave it to the pros next time.
Thank you again. I just had a question. Did this extension of Charlie's lineage come to you while you were doing Tinkers or along the way, or at what point?
The book came to me. It was after Tinkers had come out, but it sort of had kind of worldly beginnings, which is just Tinkers came out and was doing well enough, you know, before it won the prize and everything, where I was getting queries from agents. I didn't have an agent for Tinkers. And an agent with whom I really wanted to work got in touch with me, and I felt embarrassed about saying yes or no or anything without having a project underway, because I said, how would you know whether or not you'd want to represent me if you don't know what the next book is? So I used that as motive for starting to think about the second book. And the whole idea for Enon came to me just like, you know, as just a single visual image that was, it almost looked like a collage or like a paper cutout of a silhouette. And it was a sort of silhouette of a very exaggerated hillside that was studded with headstones. And across the crown of the hill was this sort of figure who was sort of crouching, and I could just tell that he was very furtive looking, and he was under the stars and the moon. And I sort of knew all at once that that person was he was Charlie Crosby, and that he was creeping home after a night of misadventure, and that his daughter Kate was buried down below, and he was sneaking behind her grave because he was ashamed of what had happened to him. And so I just basically wrote that up, and from there just started to unfold it and just let it elaborate itself more or less sort of as he told it to me. It was very, you know, intense, kind of intimate process writing the book, because the book is just, it's like I said, it's a monologue. It's one person sort of sitting right next to you confessing his experience. And so I just took dictation. That was my experience of it anyways, was just listening to him describe his experience moment by moment by moment. Yeah, the idea of the different layers of the generations. I mean, I'm just fascinated by that. You know, just anyways, I'm just interested in the fact that I'm getting deja vu. I feel like I said this in Seattle before. But, you know, like when my grandmother was alive, for example, I could sit in a room and talk with her, and she could tell me about having sat in a room with her grandfather, who was a nurse in the Union Army and had known Walt Whitman. And so that idea of like the kind of time just suddenly collapsing, and suddenly you're in a room with somebody who was in a room that was, you know, with somebody who was alive 100 and, you know, whatever number of years ago. I just love that generational interplay, and of thinking who will be, to whom am I going to be an ancestor, you know, that sort of thing. And so it was cool to, since Enon is set in the same world that Tinkers is, it was very pleasing, it was satisfying for me to be able to have some of Charlie's memories be of the generations that Tinkers was about. The generations that were that are very clearly presented in Tinkers are sort of just kind of legends to him. But I also love that idea of, you know, a fictional world persisting over a number of novels. And in that sense, you know, Faulkner is kind of my role model, the Yokna Potapa County, and I love that sense of recognition where even if you're reading, I don't know, you know, you're reading a novel about Quentin Compson or something like that, but then you see one of the, you know, you see one of the major characters from another novel sort of walk by in the background, and you go, there's Flem Snopes, I read a whole novel about him, and it just kind of opens up the whole fictional world into something that's just larger than any single book could contain. So I love that kind of open, the dimensionality of that. That's something that's just very sort of beautiful and kind of aesthetically pleasing about that. I'm sure it limited me in all sorts of ways, but every time you choose to write about A and not about B, you know, limitations are dictated to you, and they become part of what's fascinating about writing the book. You know, I can't, for example, you know, Enon's in first person. And so it's difficult with Tinkers. It was, I mean, it was just porous, and it was first person, second person, third person, present tense, past tense. With this, it was a much more intense, concentrated, focused, there's one voice. And so, I mean, what initially were difficulties in getting perspective and point of view and pulling back for kind of wide shots and sort of seeing Charlie in his larger community just to kind of triangulate what it was he was saying with the real world. Those were authorial, kind of technical authorial things to deal with. But also, I this is just a kind of a writer's trick that I always use, but I always give my characters my problems. You know, so a lot of the book ends up becoming him. I mean, his face is so, you know, the immediacy and the overwhelming nature of the tragedy that he's suffering is sort of dramatized by him constantly trying to like just step back a little bit and just get some perspective on himself in the world, because he's just so caught in the immediate kind of undertow of grief. So at one point in the book, he actually imagines like looking at himself as if he and his wife were actors on a stage in a play. And that was me sort of being able to do it too, but I gave it to him and I let that become a way that he sort of emotionally tries to negotiate. Like, wait, I gotta get a look at myself. Also, it's something that he just does. I mean, I'm a storyteller. I'm fascinated by the fact that we all tell each other, ourselves stories. And what I let Charlie do is I let him, throughout all of Enon, tell himself different stories about his daughter. And so he takes all those different generations of the town, and there are scenes where he imagines her and Sarah Good being friends together, you know, back in the sort of, you know, atemporalized version of the town. And so he makes up all these little vignettes and metaphors and legends and myths and stuff for her to be in as a way, again, to kind of to mediate the memory of her, how he negotiates with her. And I came to think of it as almost like Perseus and Medusa, where if he looks directly at the tragedy of his daughter's death, it will turn him to stone. He'll fail. But if he has that mirror, which is like literature, it's storytelling, if he looks at his daughter through the mirror of these stories and these narratives that he makes up about her, he can somehow survive. And then there's the problem of the sort of the drugs and the alcohol. So those stories become kind of increasingly kind of phantasmagoric, and it becomes very, sort of Dante, and kind of, you know, it becomes kind of infernal in a way. And so then the book sort of takes on this other aspect of him trying to sort of get himself out of that kind of habit of mind, him realizing that he's he has a conscience. He knows that I shouldn't be drinking whiskey, I shouldn't be snorting painkillers, I shouldn't be stealing my neighbor, breaking into my neighbor's houses and stealing their medicine. And yet, here I am, I'm doing it. Which is a very, again, this is an interesting thing to write about, because, you know, that goes back to, you know, St. Paul's letter to the Romans, which is, you know, the evil that I don't want to do is what I do, and the good that I mean to, I don't do. You know, I mean, there's always that, I mean, just from the most banal, like, I shouldn't eat that piece of chocolate cake. I shouldn't be smoking those cigarettes. I shouldn't be betraying my spouse. I shouldn't be, you know, looking the other way. And yet, here I am doing all these things that, you know, this is a very, very recognizable human predicament. You know, so, what was the question?
Yeah, I was reflecting on the male protagonists in both books and thinking that they're alone men, very insular in their way. And I was wondering if there's something in that you find yourself drawn to exploring.
I guess so. I mean, I guess, you know, here I am. I'm out and being sociable, and I like to go out and have a drink and see. But I mean, my experience of my own humanity is largely sort of solitary in the sense, but just in the sense that sort of consciousness feels very solitary. You actually spend most of your time in your own consciousness, you know? And so I just kind of think of these guys as they're sort of everymen. You know, they live modest lives, but they're literate, they are aware of the world, they're thoughtful, and you know, if modest, you know, kind of guy. But that idea that you kind of you do, you know, life is a kind of it's trying to do that balancing act between sort of being left to your own devices, but also sort of going, you know, fellowship, the old I and thou, as it were, and the sort of the obstacles that come up, you know, extending yourself to other people, the way that people end up getting isolated, the way that loneliness is sort of a, can be a kind of, can distill experience. So it's all that sort of stuff. I mean, sometimes I just think, oh, my next novel is going to be like one of the big French, you know, like Zola or something like that. And it's just going to be full of crowds of people brawling and fighting and, you know, having marriages and, you know, and just like, I'm going to do crowd scenes. And stuff. But then I always just end up with the guy like back in his, you know, back in some cold, stark thing, you know, sort of. So I'm kind of existential, you know, it's kind of, it's sort of, it's fascinating to me. You know, I find myself, I'm just sort of drawn to that. I also, you know, just in terms of kind of like aesthetics even, like I'm not interested in plot. I just don't care about plot. God bless people, you know, like I like to read well-plotted books. Like I kind of, as a writer, I'm not interested in it, and as a writer, I'm not particularly good at it. Like it's just not my where my disposition lies. So that said, when I think mostly of character, plot is kind of a predicate of character. It emerges out of getting to know and listening to my characters. And so if the hallmark of fiction for my own writing, or the hallmark for my own writing is character, then the hallmark of character is consciousness, you know? And so then the hallmark of that writing is that it's very experiential, and it has to do with total immersion, immersing the reader as totally as possible in sensory experience, so that's how you end up sort of you activate sort of recognition in the reader's experience. Like I felt that way. I never knew anybody else thought that or saw that or felt that way. You know, so, yeah.
So the last page that you read about, kind of where Charlie is at his messiest, maybe in his desire to fetch her back. Mm-hmm. So. The longer we live, the more loss we experience, and I understand this type of grieving that he's going through as clergy and from my own family experience.
Sure.
How did you tap into, a parent being preceded in death by a child?
Yeah, well, I'm a parent, so, you know, the moment my first child was born, I kind of understood that I was now vulnerable to a degree of grief which I really felt like I might not be able to survive. And it's just, you know, like you said, the longer you live, the more you experience that kind of loss, and the more you know people who have experienced that kind of loss. And I, you know, have dear friends who have lost children. And so, you know, when I think about writing books, I just think about, you know, you have to write about the things that are just the kind of the irreducible aspect, you know, parts of being a human being. And mortality is one of them, you know. And like I said, I'm not particularly morbid, but, you know, like, it's coming, you know. And it's sort of interesting to think about mortality to me and to think about how we negotiate it or don't try to avoid it. And so, you know, like anybody else, I have my sleepless nights where I'm worried about the world, and often what I'm worried about on those sleepless nights is just, you know, just thinking about my friends and their children. And so, since I'm a writer, that's what I wrote about. You know, I write about the things that are sort of most important. You know, kind of put all the stakes on the table and just, and like I said, you know, when I first got the idea for this book, I thought, oh my gosh, what am I getting myself into? This is practically going to be impossible to write this book. And if you take one false step, it's going to lapse into melodrama or, you know, kind of sentimentality or bathos. And I just thought, well, that's exactly the reason why, that's exactly the right challenge then as a writer. Like, you should be trying to write books that you think are too difficult for you to write, because otherwise, if you write about what you already know about, it's not even worth typing. You know, it's just propaganda. So it is that idea of just like every single sentence is just a high wire act, and you can't screw up because it could be fatal if you strike a wrong note or strike a sentimental or false note, you know. So the other thing, just in terms of it, again, it being fiction and not, say, like psychology, you don't write from theme to individual. You start with character, so you start with an individual human soul. So the book is not about grief. It's about Charlie Crosby, who's grieving. And even that distinction makes all the difference in the world between a book that maybe on the surface of it could have easier to read, because it's like, you know, the five stages of grief, you know, denial, check. And, you know, you're sort of like, then the character in the book becomes a kind of paper cutout who you're forcing into kind of more theoretical, clinical versions of these things, which, you know, have their place, you know. But in fiction writing, you know, it's sort of, fiction writing doesn't work like according to theory. It works like Faulkner always said, it's the human heart in conflict with itself. It's that immediate experience of contradiction and paradox and conflict, you know, with your own humanity. Thank you all for coming out. I appreciate it.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.